everyone. Welcome back to the Ditto Podcast. Matt and Ash here. Super excited to talk with you all today. Thanks for being here. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ashley. I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks. Have an off day today, which is always nice. Get to relax a little bit, which sometimes I'm not very good at.
I know you. What do you do with your off days when you're actually resting?
Yeah. I try and sleep in a little bit. So I think I was able to sleep until like 8:30, which is pretty good. Okay, soon as it gets light out, I'm like up, but
I know.
I do stuff like this, like for fun, like the podcast, love recording, obviously. I got a new set of watercolors, so I was painting a little bit.
Nice. Yeah.
So kind of just like
good for you.
Take time to do some of my hobbies, which is fun. And also run errands and do some chores and laundry and stuff. But
what do you paint? What do you, are you like a nature gal or what do you do?
Yeah.
Anything? Everything?
I mean, I'm not very good. So
That's okay.
Usually paint flowers. Isn't your mom pretty good at watercolors?
Yeah. Shout out to my mom. Yeah, she's pretty good. In fact, I have some on the ground here. If I was in my office at my work, they're all over my wall.
That's cool.
I like, it's so funny. It's like once a week, it feels like. It's not that once a week. More like once a month. I sent her a picture and I'm like, hey, can you do this?
Can you paint this?
And then like that's a week later, she comes over and gives me this awesome painting. So
that's cool.
She loves it. Similar, I think, to you, it's just a release. It's a downtime. It's just being present. It's a very mindful type of activity, especially for my mom, whose brain never shuts off. So it's really good for her.
Yeah, it definitely makes you slow down. I've seen some of her stuff. She's really good. I might have to have her teach me her ways, but
she would love to. She would love to.
That's awesome.
Hey, I have, instead of a dad joke today, I actually have something kind of funny / awkward to tell you. You ready?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay, well, so I went and got a massage the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, do you get a lot of like medical massage, athlete massages? Do you, is that kind of in your routine?
Yeah, like sport massages.
Sports massages, that's what it's called. They're so awesome. And so I just went and got it. Usually at the end of every semester, for sure every academic year, I try to go get a massage. Just, you know, stress management, and I love getting massages.
Self-care.
yeah. Okay, so I'm getting a massage, and she's like 3 minutes in, okay? Mm-hmm. And she goes, okay, kind of in the whisper voice that they do, right, trying to set the mood. And she goes, okay, I'm going to start with some pressure, and then I'll check back in every so often to see how that pressure is. I'm like, okay, perfect. And then she goes, if it's too hard, just say pineapple.
Oh my gosh. What?
And she was dead serious. And I'm like, okay, I'll say pineapple. Can I not just say it's
that's too much?
Hot?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So did you ever have to say pineapple?
No, I didn't want to have to say it because it was so dumb. Oh my gosh.
I was
just settling in. I was getting relaxed. And then she says this, and I like internally, I'm like, what did she? And I try not to laugh because it's quiet.
Oh my gosh.
Pineapple. Have you ever heard that from a massage therapist?
No, like a code word? I've never heard a code word. Usually they just say, is the pressure good?
Yeah.
And I say, yes. Too much? Too little?
I know.
Oh man.
Anyways, it was really funny. I could barely get through the next 5 minutes, and then it started to relax again. It was fine, but oh my gosh, it was so funny and so awkward.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Yeah, I've never heard that before.
Pineapple. But that should be our code word, Ashley, for like if we have a guest on and it's too awkward or something, we should just be like, pineapple. Pineapple. let's end the conversation. Pineapple.
Yeah. Next Anyways. Topic. That's so funny. Very
Isn't
interesting
funny?
Code word. Yeah.
Pineapple.
Wow.
So Anywho, I just wanted to share that with you because I thought it was funny. But.
That is hilarious. That's a good substitute for a dad joke.
I know, right? I needed something funny, and so I thought that would be funny. Yeah. I do have a dad joke for our next episode, but that one I'll stick with. Anyways, so.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Well, for today, we're doing something that we haven't done before. We're going to do a part one and a part two.
Yay. Of
our topic, which today is, drum roll, deliberate practice.
Oh, cool.
So, Matt, can you tell us a little bit more about deliberate practice?
I know. This is such a outside, at least in my opinion, outside kind of the realm of like psychology and kind of sports psychology. Obviously, that's my wheelhouse. This is a lot of like motor behavior and coaching and a lot of implicit psychological undertones, this concept of deliberate practice. Anyways, nonetheless, extremely important. So this one especially, Ashley, I think will be really interesting to coaches / parents that are organizing the entire kind of life cycle of an athlete, if that makes sense. So going to practice and what they're eating and how they're practicing and what they're doing at practice and what they're doing when they're recovering and how they're recovering and all of these wonderful things, but especially focused around intentionally and objectively finding progress and cultivating that progress along this wonderful journey of bettering yourself as an athlete. So very much in the athletic space, deliberate practice, but I think you can apply this to business, to relationships, to music, whatever domain you might find yourself in. Anyway, so here we go. Should we get into it? Here we go.
Let's do it.
Anders Ericsson, back in the early 90s, maybe even the 80s, he was the first one to essentially discover and author this concept of deliberate practice. Anders Ericsson, I think, passed away shortly, a couple years ago, maybe even three-ish years ago. Yes, again, he was in sports psychology, but he was much more in motor behavior, coach education, etc., at Florida State. So he was a big-time Florida State researcher in and around deliberate practice and a lot of the other these kind of directly and indirectly concepts that are related to this. So, in fact, he wrote a book that you all would love. Oh, my gosh. Well, let me find the exact title so I can leave it in here. It's called Peak, P-E-A-K. And the subtitle is Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. And that's a newer book, 2016, so newish. And I think, again, he passed away 2020, 2021, around there. But he wrote that, and it's like essentially this wonderful accumulation of all of this awesome research that he put into this book and put it in kind of into layman terms. So if you're interested, Peak is a masterful read, wonderful book. So part one, here we go. We're going to go over, is it seven, Ashley? One, two, three,
yeah, there's
four,
seven,
five, six, seven. Yeah, so seven different really kind of guideposts as you go about deliberately practicing something. So if you really want to get better at something, whether it's shooting PKs or just soccer in general, or if it's music, or if it's business, or again, anything else that you might want to get better at in the domain that you might be in, this is a wonderful guideline or wonderful approach in how you can go about doing this. So seven of these. We're going to go over four for the first one, and then we're going to end this next episode, part two, with the three. So what's the first one? And we're following this acronym called EXPERTS, E-X-P-E-R-T-S. Okay, so this is, again, from Anders Ericsson, but it's also from David Eccles, who was, because Dr. Ericsson passed away, a colleague at Florida State as well, and he studies this and puts this in the practice and stuff as well. First one, E, established training techniques. So what does this mean? Essentially, it's just tried and true methods that's grounded in research and practice to be able to improve your performance. And so I think of this one especially from a strength and conditioning standpoint. I dabbled in strength and conditioning earlier in my professional career. And you have to, as a strength and conditioning coach, broadly speaking, really progressively overload the individual. And so you're doing what they call blocked and random practice in motor learning. You're undulating practices with different lifts and different calisthenics and different plyometrics and different cardiovascular, all of these different things. You're progressively helping these athletes get better. And so here's my question first for you, Ash. I know you've been in the strength training world, at least right indirectly. I know you weren't at strength coach, but you've worked with a lot of different strength coaches.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience been like in seeing your individual progression mm-hmm. from progressively, in a very deliberate way, overloading your strength training, your cardiovascular training, so you can get faster and stronger and more technically sound? What's been, kind of broadly speaking, your experience with this first one?
Yeah, I mean, as you were talking about it, the word that came to my mind was periodization. It's a pretty common word in our world. We are strength coaches and are like actual coaches. Like, they do a really good job of kind of periodizing our week. Mm-hmm. Not only our week, but like our whole year, week after week, and from the beginning of the season, preseason, all the way to the end of season, and how we're supposed to hit certain metrics and certain marks at certain points of the year. And that's the same with our strength coaches as well. Certain weeks, we, like this week, for example, we have a few more training days than we have in the past. So mm-hmm. the last 2 days of training, we had higher loads on the field, but also in the gym. So we were overloading our bodies so that we can then get stronger, and we can then hopefully in the future handle higher loads. So is that kind of what you're talking about? Because as you're talking about that, that's kind of what came to my mind.
Yeah, no, 100%. Something that I've noticed being outside the strength and conditioning world the last 10 years is the emphasis that strength coaches are now putting on recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I think for many years, I don't know how long, but for many of them, it was like 365. We got to get after it all year round. Like, right. And we have to get stronger. We have to get faster. And now with a lot of new science and a lot of new techniques, you have to equally, and in some cases, even more so, emphasize recovery as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as an athlete, so whether this is a parent listening or a coach or whomever, we have to prioritization, both the recovery and the actual training part of this, especially if it's as physical as something like soccer. I remember, again, being in strength and conditioning, and at least for college football, so I was at the University of Utah for a little bit, there was winter conditioning, and that was essentially January to spring, so kind of April. 1st of April.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like full go hard conditioning. And it was a lot of strength training, and it was a lot of plyometrics, and it was a lot of cardio. And then of course the nutrition factors were different at that time because of all this hard training that these student athletes were doing. Then spring happened and it tailored off a little bit. So now they're getting into the actual tactical work when it comes to actual football. Then they go into summer conditioning. It's not as hard as winter conditioning, but they're tactically looking at what is the progression of this now to continue to keep them in shape, keep them fast, keep them strong, keep them flexible. And then come fall or come season, and I know strength coaches for the Washington Spirit are probably very similar in how they approach kind of an annual prioritization of this. With fall or in season, it's then tailored off even more because of the demand that competition has on the human body. And you can't be equally training as hard, right, during the season mm-hmm. and still expect to perform really well on Saturday, Sundays, or whenever you're playing. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially what we're talking about, being able to find tried and true methods that are grounded in research and practice so that your athlete, or you the athlete, can have a established training technique. I would recommend, and I know Ashley would agree with this, is finding professionals that are educated, that are certified, and that have the experience to be able to, depending on the age, depending on the gender, depending on the sport, can provide that best application for that type of training. So anyways, that's the first one. So establish training techniques. Now, very quickly, what does this look like from a psychological standpoint, or what could this look like? When we look at mental rehearsal, and especially imagery under mental rehearsal, a progression of imagery could be, and this is often what I do with a lot of athletes, is including an imagery script in this mental rehearsal protocol. That's something that's really familiar and really simple. And so oftentimes when we're starting with imagery, again, we're progressing here, just like in strength training, I have them write out a script that is of their childhood home, and they're going through their home in this imagery process. They're just strengthening something that's really familiar, but they're going inside and then they're feeling what's inside their home. They're seeing, they're smelling, they're cutting open a lemon and they're tasting a lemon in the kitchen of their own home. So something that's really simple and really familiar. Then as they progress in that and they get more familiar with that, we move on to more sports specific scenarios, and we're again including all of these wonderful things that imagery is included. So that's what it could look like, at least from a mental standpoint, very quickly. Ashley, comments, questions with any of that? I know that was so much. I feel like I'm just dabbling off a ton of stuff here.
No, I feel like that was really good. I think we touched on a lot of like kind of high level of how this would work, you know, mostly in like the college game or in the professional game. When it comes to like parents with kids who are younger, how would you advise them to establish these training techniques? Because I feel like that's kind of a problem that we're seeing in the youth game is like, obviously like youth coaches are great, but sometimes you see kids playing like 4 to 5 games a weekend and they're very much overloading themselves on soccer specifically, like playing soccer over and over, which is great to get minutes and to be playing, but also how can parents help establish their training techniques for their child specifically if their current team isn't really necessarily paying attention to it? Because I feel like at the youth game, coaches are just, you know, paid to coach and they do their best, but also there's not really that full service of like a strength and conditioning coach and like I said, a conditioning coach, a nutritionist, someone telling them like, hey, like you had a really high load, maybe recover, or are you paying attention to all these things? What advice would you give parents who have like young kids and how to establish their own kind of training techniques?
I know. Such a great question. My advice going back is finding actual professionals to try at least indirectly to help you with some of these protocols. Leaning on people that have studied this, that are certified in this, and that have dedicated their lives towards this. I think that would be first and foremost extremely beneficial, because a lot of parents, they see YouTube and TikTok and go, oh my gosh, they need to play 6 games a week because every other kid is doing this, or this person did this when they were growing up. Well, again, there also needs to be an emphasis on recovery as well. And so leaning on experts, I think, is going to be hugely beneficial in how you can go about in a very deliberate, pun intended, way to establish these type of routines. The other thing is, and this is just kind of a 30,000 foot viewpoint from youth sports specifically, I am getting into this scene slowly. I have an almost 8-year-old and a 4 and a half year old. We need to freaking stop being so competitive at such young ages. And I know this is such a huge societal problem, but we're taking the fun out of so many of these experiences from youth sport, and we're taking competition to a whole new level. It shouldn't, honestly, Ashley, like, it shouldn't be highly competitive, in my opinion, until you're like high school, junior, senior year, I think is when you should start seeing real competition come into play. And even then it's like, we still need to be having fun. And these kids are still kids and they still need to go out and just play and get dirty and enjoy joy of life. But because they're playing 6 games and they're on this AAU team, they can't do these things. Well, we as coaches and as parents and as adults need to look at these these practice routines, these training techniques, and alter them, I think, tremendously, and even dumb them down tremendously, especially for these youth athletes. And so it's really kind of also taking a look in the mirror and going, what are we doing as adults, as parents, with a lot of these youth athletes, a lot of these younger players, to give them a better experience? Anyways, I know that's such a broader topic and broader conversation that we could have, but yeah, those are my thoughts. So, yeah. Okay. Should we go on to the second one?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So we're on this acronym EXPERTS. So this next one is existing. So the X is within the existing skills as building blocks. And so this one I think is really fascinating. I would love your insight into this, obviously, Ashley. It's essentially utilizing, if we're working with an individual, utilizing what the individual already knows and what they already can do as kind of this launching pad to learn more complex and more refined skills. Mm-hmm. And so it's like scaffolding, like you're building and building and utilizing, again, what they already have. And so an example of this could be like a former gymnast learning Olympic lifts. So they're doing snatches and clean and jerks in the weight room. So you're translating body awareness of what an Olympic gymnast can do, or what a gymnast can do, and translating that in now into the weight room. Because when you do a snatch or a clean and jerk, you have to have body awareness. Mm-hmm. And so the foundation, the launch pad is, ooh, they're a gymnast. They're really aware of their body. Let's utilize that strength to learn more complex Olympic / weight training techniques like the snatch and the clean and jerk. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, and maybe you've done this with just yourself and there hasn't been a coach or there hasn't been a trainer, but have you experienced this where you've gone into a setting, whether it's on the field and, you know, actually playing soccer or maybe in the weight room, and found that, ooh, there's things that I already know and that I'm already good at that I can use as a launch pad to learn more complex and refined skills so that I can leverage this power. Mm-hmm. Has that experience happened with you in being a professional?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like running track in high school really helped me build like kind of
100%
foundational like sprinting mechanics. Yep. And I didn't really like notice it at the time just because I was running track because I enjoyed it and it was fun. And I was also playing soccer. But as I continued to go on throughout my soccer career, I was super grateful for that foundation that I had of just basic sprinting mechanics. And I ran the hurdles as well. So like just overall like hip mobility and sprinting mechanics was super helpful, because as I continued to play like professionally and we started working on like sprinting, accelerating, decelerating, change of direction, and like the importance of those mechanics, I was like so grateful for that like base foundation that I had that some of my teammates hadn't had experience with, because they only played soccer. And so I was even like in the gym when we would do like explosive work or sprint drills to help that translate onto the field, especially as a striker when like your speed and your power is really important. I just like loved it and it gave me a lot more confidence, and I wanted to continue working on it because I had those existing skills and that base foundation. A lot of my teammates at first who've had no experience were very discouraged and hated doing sprint drills and like mechanics and speed and power work because they had never done it before or never really, like they didn't know how to do like an A skip or just kind of like the rhythm of those different types of like skips and hurdle drills. So I think for me, that's a perfect example of like playing and doing multiple sports can actually like help you on the pitch as a soccer player. A lot of parents or coaches think that like, no, you have to choose one or the other, or if you want to be good at a specific sport, you have to spend all your time in that specific sport. But for me, like playing soccer and also running track really went hand in hand and really helped me ultimately in my professional career.
Yeah. Oh, couldn't have said it better. Another great example of why youth athletes should be playing way more than just one sport, especially while they're in that youth phase. Beautiful, beautiful example. They're building on these building blocks. Another very quick example that I was able to do in working with the U.S. Army, we helped them with mindfulness and more specifically with breathing techniques. And they were already doing some of that because as you shoot your weapon in the military, it's weapon, it's not rifle in the military. I called it a rifle one time and I was corrected vehemently. It's your weapon. And so anyways, when you're shooting a weapon, breathing is of the utmost importance. Exhaling and inhaling and when you're supposed to shoot. And so bringing in that building block and building it even further on deliberate breathing and mindfulness techniques was huge in what we were doing specifically with the U.S. Army.
Cool.
Awesome. Okay. Existing skills as building blocks. Number three, the P, pushing the envelope. This is an interesting one. So essentially what this is meaning is you're leaning into the edge of your current capabilities. So it's just outside your comfort zone because we know, whether it's implicitly or explicitly, that it's really where growth happens, just outside that comfort zone. So you're not going too far and you're not breaking down or burning out, but you're keenly aware of when those things are occurring and then staying kind of in that happy medium, not quite burnout, not breaking down, but also not getting too comfortable and pushing yourself. I remember just a brief example, working at a chiropractor's office. I was a chiropractic tech when I was going through my bachelor's degree. I was trying to discover what career I wanted to go in, folks, go into. And I remember folks coming in, patients coming in, and we did workouts with them, whether it was a leg extension because there was a total knee replacement or whatever it might be. And it was really interesting to teach these, especially older folks, the difference between being sore and pushing and actually hurting something. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes a lot of people think soreness, and my daughter's discovering this right now as she's doing gymnastics. She just told me her ribs were breaking. She's like, I think my ribs are breaking. My bones are on the side of my core. I'm like, no. Gymnastics is a lot of core. You're working your muscles and they're starting to build. And so anyways, just an example of you got to push and you got to get used to that soreness, but you don't also want to injure yourself. Mm-hmm. So anyways, insight, thoughts onto this throughout your career. And I'm sure you have plenty.
Yeah. I love this one. I think pushing the envelope is a perfect way to describe that area of growth. And I think, like, if you have all the things before it, you have an established training technique, a kind of like rhythm or pattern, you know that you have those foundational skills and building blocks, then it allows you to get to the point where you can push the envelope and see that actual growth. For me, like when I'm training kids or like working with a team or youth players, and say we're doing like a very like simple, I don't know, foot skills drill, a lot of them will do it to where they're comfortable and they won't want to do it any like faster or quicker or add in a little wrinkle to make them mess up. Cause we, as athletes, as competitors, we love trying to be perfect or making things, just going to the point where we can go as fast as we can without messing up. But a lot of times I encourage them to go to the point where they actually mess up, because once you mess up, then that's where you can improve, and that's where you can like actually gain small little steps towards getting even better, getting even faster. So it's really fun to encourage players, even myself, encourage myself to step into a zone of being uncomfortable. And we really don't like it, but when you push the envelope to a point where you're a little bit uncomfortable, then that's where the real growth happens. And that's really, really fun. Cause I can look back on my career and I could be like, oh, I remember when like shooting the ball with my left foot was super uncomfortable and I hated forcing myself to do it. I hated pushing the envelope, but now I'm at a point where it's like, okay, I can shoot the ball very comfortably with my left foot, and I wouldn't have gotten here if I didn't push the envelope a little bit and force myself out of my comfort zone. So yeah, I love this one a lot because I feel like it's super important for any type of skill development or growth.
Totally.
And yeah.
Yeah. And I think you've become so competent at it, Ashley. It's really developing a great relationship with not pushing too much, but pushing enough. I think you have to get to that skill level to be able to recognize, ooh, yeah, this is a good push, or this is maybe too much, or it's not enough. And that awareness, I think, needs to be developed over time. And it, again, just like a skill set, like anything else. I love it.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, ready for our last one, at least for this part one?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is enhancing mental representations. Now, here is the sports psychology, very specifically, one that I love. This one is essentially about creating internal maps and models to formulate your skills in situations. So we talked about earlier about mental rehearsal. And within mental rehearsal, you have visualization, which essentially you're using the vision system, internal or external, or imagery, which is utilizing smell, eyes, so vision, taste, hearing, and your feel. So all five of your senses are coming alive with imagery. That's what this is all about. And if I had to sum it up in one phrase, it's making the uncomfortable comfortable. And so it really speaks to pushing the envelope as well. And so working with athletes, and in fact, actually, I'm working with an amazing athlete right now. She does jiu-jitsu, and she's going to world championships at the end of this month.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And something that she's been doing is she's been watching film of past competitions and learning from that. So she's creating these external maps that are then facilitating her mental rehearsal imagery practice. So then we've come up with a wonderful script that she goes over. And she goes through what it feels like to step onto the mat. Is she hearing the ref's whistle? She's feeling everything that really has to be felt as a grappler in jiu-jitsu. There's so much feel in jiu-jitsu. She's tasting. She has to wear a mouthpiece, and so she's tasting her mouthpiece. So she's going through right now, and she's 3 weeks out before she goes to world championships. She's going through in her mind what this could be like and what she already has experienced. So again, in theory, she'll be able to create uncomfortable pressure, high pressure situations, and make them just a little more comfortable because of these representations mentally that she's creating. Mm-hmm. What has this been like for you as an athlete?
I love this one. I feel like this is a very underused skill in the world of sports, especially from an individual standpoint, but also from a team standpoint. Like, I feel like I could share so many examples of this for me personally, especially with like my PK routine or just like preparing for a game, like a championship game or a game that I'm maybe a little bit extra like nervous for. But an example that comes to my mind is last year, our team preparing for playoffs and the potential of a PK shootout. We worked with our mental performance coach, David, and we had a team meeting, and we essentially did this kind of mental representation as a team. And we talked about, like, we got in like smaller groups. We talked about like the different scenarios that we could be in, what it would look like, how we would act, what our like team routine would be. And sure enough, in the semifinal, we played Gotham at home, and it went to a PK shootout, and we dialed in, and we just...
Oh, I love it.
It was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
Because we were all on the same page. It's like we had already been there together as a team. Of course, everyone as individuals, like, prepared and practiced, but like as a team and as a collective, like mentally, we were already there because we had visualized it. Like, okay, when this happens, we're going to do this. When this happens, we're going to do this. Like, you have your buddy system. You're going to hand this person the ball. And like, because we already felt comfortable with that like routine and like visualized it as a group, like it was one of the most perfect PK shootouts I've ever been a part of.
And you were way more comfortable because of that preparation. Oh,
yeah, we were so comfortable, and we won, and it was great. And it was just so fun to see the team's reaction of like, guys, we did it. Like, we were prepared. Like, it really paid off. And so, yeah, I couldn't say enough good things about mental representations of just like adding that to your game, because it'll just enhance everything else that you've done to prepare. Because we always prepare physically with, you know, practice, because that's something that we're always doing. But how can you give yourself that extra edge? And it's definitely the mental side of it, and just like visualizing, preparing, just preparing yourself in your mind before you go out there of what it may or could look like, because then you're familiarizing yourself with it and you've already been there, so it's not as new to you.
God, so beautiful. And Ashley's not saying when you do mental rehearsal and you do these mental representations, this fourth one, that it's going to be this way every time. It's going to prepare you for the exact scenario. In reality, we really don't know what's going to happen, especially in something as unknown as and wonderful as sport can be. Mm-hmm. That was very fortuitous, right, for you and your team that you happened to actually go into that situation. But here's the thing. This also speaks to the second one, existing skills as building blocks. If you're doing mental representations, creating these internal maps, and something different happens, you can still utilize building blocks from your imagery to supplement whatever it is that you are actually doing. And that also, in theory, is going to be facilitative. So there's just so many wonderful benefits to mental rehearsal and these mental representations. So.
Yeah. Well, and to add on to that too, like, I think something that helps is sometimes, and you can correct me if you disagree, but sometimes you don't have to be super specific with it. We can be very general in like, how am I going to respond when a mistake happens? Cause that can be applied in many different ways and many different aspects. So like something like, say, losing the ball, that will most likely happen in the game. So can I mentally prepare myself and visualize how I'm going to respond, something that I can control in the game? So like, you don't have to always visualize like good things, like, okay, I want it to go perfectly this way, so I'm going to visualize it this way and it's going to go that way. You can be like, okay, how am I going to set myself up for success? I'm going to respond, you know, by just trying to regain the ball if I lose it. And if I lose it, I'm going to let it go and just ask for the ball again. So like things that like can be very like broad, but can be applied to like any situation in the game, I think is also like very helpful. And doesn't always have to be like positive situations. It can be situations that are like setbacks. Anything. Yeah. Like literally anything. And yeah, I think that's just as helpful. Yeah, definitely.
Total. The two most important components to this, Ashley, the literature points to when it comes to mental rehearsal, vividness and controllability. If we have those things in store, in check, in these mental representations, you can create any image, any scenario that you desire, as long as we have those two.
I like
Anyways.
That's cool.
There's our first four. Should we end with ditto of the day? How, what is it? D-O, yes. Ditto of D-O-T-R. No. What is it?
ditto of the day. D-O-T-D.
No, yes. There's no R. I don't know why I have an R. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'd love to. Okay. My ditto of the day, there's so many great things that we talked about, but I'm going to have to go with pushing the envelope. I really, as I've gotten more experience in my career, I actually like really look forward to the moments when I can push the envelope. I feel like before, when I was like younger, I felt like, oh, I don't want to push the envelope, or I'm like scared of those moments that are going to like make me get better or push me out of my comfort zone. Now I understand, like, because we have to have this like rhythm and pattern of training, and you want to manage your loads and all this kind of stuff, push those moments of pushing the envelope don't really come around as often as you think they do, because you're at a certain skill level, because you've reached a certain level. So I really love those moments where it's like, okay, today is going to be a hard day. We're going to push ourselves, yada, 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 whatever, because they don't come around as often as they used to when I was younger and less experienced. And so I think living your life in a way where you're looking for those moments where you can push the envelope, like you said, it's in a controlled way, but it's in an exciting, fun way, is really fun. So I'm going to go with pushing the envelope.
I love it. I loved all of the stuff we talked about as well. Pushing the envelope was one of my top ones. To just be different, I'll go with existing skills as building blocks. Oftentimes, we already have a lot of the skills that we're trying to get better at. We just need a really good coach, and a really good educator is one that can pull those out naturally. Now, I get it. DNA plays a factor, and sometimes we have natural inclinations to be a little bit faster, a little bit stronger, a little bit more tactically sound, but we also have strengths. And so pulling those strengths out of us, utilizing those to build off of, is such a wonderful way to deliberately practice skill sets.
Beautiful.
Anyways, yay! Awesome.
Awesome. Cool. Well, that's it for Deliberate Practice Part 1. Stay tuned next week for Deliberate Practice Part 2. And if you like this episode, please like, share, subscribe. We really appreciate you guys being here. And ditto out.
Ditto out.